Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here, sitting across from me.
Is Gary LeMaster. I'm filling in for Mike, the beloved co-host,
Mike Cosentino, who's
apparently playing hooky this morning.
We're going to talk about a very controversial and very widely read, and here comes my beloved co-host now, just slightly late, article that's appeared in the Atlantic magazine. Atlantic magazine is one of a couple of sort of intellectual issues magazines, and it's sort of neither right nor left, that's been around for 150 years. The other one's Harper's Magazine. Atlantic's been around forever. But in the, in the May 21st Atlantic, a man named Ta-Hisi Coates wrote an article which is receiving incredibly wide discussion, and it's called The Case for Reparations, 250 years of slavery, 90 years of Jim Crow, 60 years of separate but equal, 35 years of racist housing policy. Until we reckon with our compounding moral debts, America will never be whole. I guess that last is the line. Until we reckon with our compounding moral debts, America will never be whole. Ta-Hisi Coates, born in 1975 in Baltimore, one of seven kids. His father was a Vietnam vet and a former Black Panther. He had a little tiny publishing company called Black Classics Publishing. Ta-Hisi never did very well in school. He's now a senior editor at the Atlantic magazine. And we're going to be discussing his article about reparations. And one of the things he starts with is in the early part of the around after the American Revolution, he has a case where a Black woman came in and said, "I worked for this Tory for 50 years and he's left and I'm left with nothing. And I want a percentage of the estates." And most of you guys know, if you were a Tory and you sided with England and you skipped to Canada because the Americans were after you, that you confiscated your land. And the court ruled that she was entitled to money from that estate. They didn't think reparations was a big deal. Of course, it's easier to give money to somebody from somebody's estate who you consider a traitor than it is from the local sheriff or the magistrate. But they did rule in her favor, and they gave her a share of the money that she did for all these years that she worked as a slave.
It's an easier thing to think about reparations for an individual too in an individual case than it is for an entire, you know, ethnic group.
I guess the biggest case of reparations in the world is Germany, the millions and hundreds of millions and billions of dollars they paid out for what they did during the Holocaust. Very controversial in Germany, took a huge political fight to start paying the money. A huge controversy in Israel, where a whole lot of people did not want to take any money from the Germans at all. And there's a quote from Ben-Gurion, who helped found the Israeli state, who said, "If I could go there with a couple of jeeps and some machine guns and get this money, I would do it. But we can't do it, so we'll take the money because we need it." And it was a huge percentage of Israel's money for investment and stuff, something like 15%. I may have the percentage wrong. So reparations, no one's discussed it, I think, hardly in decades. It's only been considered by certain far-out left radicals, some Black nationalists and stuff. And so Ta-Hisi Coates has brought it to the public discussion by bringing it up.
Yeah, this is the most liberal kind of liberal thing that we've ever liberaled here. There's not much room to the left of me. But reparations for African Americans, I recognize, not that I'm not in favor of it, the stories are horrendous, story after story after story, building country clubs on land that was stolen from hard-working black families from 1930s and 1960s until the Fair Housing Act of 68. All you realtors out there know what the Fair Housing, because it's on your test, the Fair Housing Act of 1968 stopped the predatory lending. You couldn't get a mortgage in this country if you were black, and a lot of it, until 1968.
That's right, and the kind of mortgage you could get was tremendously predatory. And what Tennessee Coates does is he doesn't concentrate on slavery and all the labor, all the unpaid labor of hundreds of years of slavery.
People owning other people.
He doesn't talk about that. He focuses on the cruelty of things like redlining, and we'll discuss that in a bit, but and all the exploitation after the Civil War is long over, after Reconstruction is mostly destroyed. And he shows that, well, Gary has some statistics, right?
It's still going on. But, you know, I mean, that's the thing that we can't lose sight of. I mean, in Michigan, just a couple of years ago, the governor took over and the state legislature took over a predominantly black city, and we're going to take a park that was willed to the city and build large development and golf course on it for rich white people. So this hasn't ended. In 2008, following the housing crash, there's lots of that stuff.
But at one time, black folks owned a lot more property, right, Gary, than they did later on.
Big difference is they have laws now. Before, what I'm talking about, the laws were on their on the side of the predator.
That's exactly what the folks who were ripped off said.
We can start with Jim Crow. We can start with the laws after reconciliation. We can and finish with the fair housing, contract financing.
So
they would buy houses for double what the speculators bought them for, up would jump a new item in the contract. We forgot to tell you about the insurance that you have to pay for. Well, no, sir, the insurance wasn't in the contract. I read the contract. Well, it is now. So they could change the contract during the course of the contract.
If I could, throw out a couple of statistics, and Steve asked for us that, I think most of us, at least I did, thought that the 40 acres and a mule kind of took care of everything after the Civil War. But that never really happened. There were nearly a million acres set aside for that purpose, and within a few years that had all gone back to the original slave owners. But the vast majority of it had.
Coates tells exactly how it happens to one family, folks, so it makes it less abstract. Go on, Gary.
By 1910, so what happened following the Civil War, and keep in mind, we're only 3 to 5 generations removed from the end of the Civil War. My great-grandfathers fought in it. But by 1910, African-Americans, former slaves, had acquired some land, simply by purchasing it. And as a result of their hard work. And so by 1910, they owned 15 million acres of land. But by 1997, from the kinds of things that Steve has talked about, that number was down to 2 million. So from 15 million acres of land owned by African Americans down to 2 million in 97. And then in more recent events, that's, I'm sure, diminished, much more.
Let's talk a little bit how it worked. And I have some personal experience growing up in a small town of Claremore, Oklahoma. And my first job when I was still in high school was working in a TV repair appliance sales shop. And the scariest thing we did was to go out in rural Oklahoma. There wasn't the gun cult then. All the men had been in World War II. They were all trained in using rifles and stuff. But there wasn't the gun cult. On the other hand, repossessing somebody's TV was a very, very dangerous job. And as a young teenager, they would send me to the door to knock on the house to see if anybody was home. And then one of these burly, rough guys that I worked with would go in and kick in the door. We'd grab the TV, we'd throw it in the back of the truck and roar off. One day they took me over to Tulsa to pick up, which is a large city near Claremore, to pick up some appliances and stuff. And they took me to a store in the middle of the largest black neighborhood in Tulsa. And they said to me, and they were sort of sneering, they said, "Do you know how this works? Do you know how these guys make their money?" And I said, "No, I've got no idea." He says, "They sell and resell the same appliances to black people." He said, if you lose your job, you get behind on the payments, they come and take your refrigerator, they clean it up, and they sell it again. And we drove down the street. He said, "This is how it works," they said to me. "You see that used car place with all those cars there? They sell those cars. They have a really high, high interest rate on them. When people can't pay them, they repossess them, they clean them up, and resell them." He says some of those cars have been sold 6 or 7 times to different people.
Isn't this what title loan companies are all about?
Yeah, this is predatory loaning. Now, the same kind of predation, the same kind of predatory loaning is what Mike was talking about earlier, is in redlining certain areas of the city. When an area is redlined, and I think I'd like to thank Tennessee Coates for bringing up the word redlining, which no one's discussed in a long time. It was actually a colored map with different things. So blue would be the area where it was best to make a loan. If you got redlined, if you were in a red line district, no banks would loan you any money. So it didn't matter if you're a middle class black family or not. You could not borrow money from any of the banks to buy your house that you were living in, or your apartment building, or your business, your little store. You couldn't borrow the money. And that's what redlining did. But people, black, white, everybody wants to own their own home. Everybody wants their, or at least a lot of people want their own business.
Oh, it's a single route in this country.
Yes.
For any kind of wealth.
Almost all the wealth of the non-top 2 to 10%, almost all the wealth is in housing. And that's why you see the extreme reaction.
For working men and women.
Yeah. For the rest of us, most of our wealth, if we have any wealth at all, is in our houses. And so it's an extremely sensitive area. And so what happened is Tennessee shows that how completely they were cut out of the housing market, except there were people who had what they called contract loans. Contract loan looks like a regular loan, and except that the seller of the house owns the house until you pay off the contract. You don't have any equity. If you fail on one payment, they take the house back.
This is not to be confused with contract for deed sales.
Yeah.
Which have a balloon period.
This is the way it was done. So you couldn't get a house, but with a regular loan, you couldn't go down to the bank and get a loan. And so the only way you could get a loan was one of these deals, and the houses got repossessed. And it starts off by the 70s. There's a real movement in Chicago against this practice, but it didn't matter. I mean, there was a Jewish community that invited black folks in and said, "We'll sell you houses and stuff." But when they arrived, they couldn't get mortgages, and so they had to get these contract mortgages that basically you don't get your equity out of them. And this is the same way they sold appliances to these folks and stuff. And, you know, Coates does one fellow, I think the guy's name is, let me get it, he's now 91 years old, Clyde Ross. And it's a story of how he moved from Mississippi to Chicago and how he signed one of these contracts. Says that he was embarrassed, that he felt stupid that he signed this contract, that they ripped him off. He said a lot of people were embarrassed of how naive they were. And some people that were interviewed knew that it was a ripoff, but they did it anyway, right? Because they wanted their own home.
Well, that's true. And he was embarrassed because he moved out of Mississippi. He moved out of the South where sharecropping had the same kind of terrible consequences. In other words, sharecropping didn't work where for African American families where the crop was split 50-50.
Well, they just wouldn't split the crop 50-50. Well, right? Barrels of cotton, bundles of cotton would disappear.
The owner would come up with all sorts of charges on the other, so that the family, the African-American family, was left in debt at the end of the season and therefore would come back or to work at the next season to pay off the debt. And they made sure that the family was in debt at the end of every season. They realized that the deck was stacked. Now, the consequences in Mississippi for not going along with that was often lynching.
Yeah.
At least getting beat up. So what do you do? The flight, the millions of African Americans, I believe 6 million in the process coming north, they said, they experienced that. He talked about this very much. He joined the army. He had to take his chances with the army.
Ended up on Guam
during the war. Right.
Would have given him a deferment because he was a farmer. Ended up on Guam. Came back. These guys come back from after World War I, there are a tremendous number of lynchings and lots of violence against black folks because the black veterans come back and they don't want to put up with this stuff
anymore. It was the height of the KKK.
Yeah. And the same way after World War II, the veterans come back. They've been, out, in the army and they don't want to suddenly be put back in their place in Mississippi, and they head north where they can walk on the street. No one pushes them aside. They don't have to tip their hats. They don't have to defer to everybody. They can go into a grocery store and buy groceries. They can go to a restaurant and sit down and have lunch. But there are millions of people heading north, right, Mike? And there's only certain places they can live. They can't just go move anywhere in Chicago they want to move because there's all these, in fact, some violence if you even try to move into a white neighborhood.
According to one realtor I know, today, all realtors in 2014 know about redlining. All of them now know what redlining means and how it functions. So it's not that things are better. Laws are better. But it hasn't gone away, as we've talked about. So,
give you an example. And my dad was a banker in Claremore, and one day one of his clients come to him, and he used the N word. He said, "What's wrong, Monty? Every time I come here, every blank in town is sitting in line to get a loan from you."
Yeah.
And my father said, "Well, I don't think that's true." And so he asked the minister who was. In the Jewish term is a mocker. He was the heavy in the black community. And, he said, "I don't think everybody comes to me." And the minister said, "Well, Monty, there's a few folks that might go to somebody over at the other bank." And so my dad was an innocent. He was raised in the military. He spent his whole life traveling around the world as an army brat. And so my dad said, "Well, why do they come to me, Reverend? Because I don't treat them any different than I treat white people." So my dad is telling me this story, and I'm trying to say, "Well, kind of that's what they're looking for, Dad."
Yeah, exactly.
But he said, "You know what the man said to me?" And I said, "No." He said, "We just appreciate that you're a real professional banker, Mr. Williamson." So the guy didn't get to be the leader of the community for no reason. He came up. So my dad was absolutely convinced that they had decided he was a professional banker. He wasn't an integrationist kind of guy. He wasn't political. He just was business oriented. And if a black guy had exactly the same credit rating as a white guy, he's going to loan him money.
Well, we discovered your liberal roots and where they come from. That, not treating people differently. What an outrageous, un-American activity.
And my dad said, "You don't need to go to those demonstrations that you go to. Look how I solved this problem." He said, "Look how I integrated the swimming pool. Yeah. I told the guy who had the franchise I wouldn't extend his loan unless he integrated the swimming pool. Look, he integrated the swimming pool." I said, "Dad, you managed to do this, but I said, suppose they'd gone to Harry. They wouldn't have gotten a loan. They wouldn't have gotten an integrated swimming pool." Yeah. It was one of those things where the swimming pool is integrated 3 days a week and unintegrated 4 days a week. So,
in a lot of areas,
if you don't have somebody somebody willing to do that, then you're in real trouble. You can't get the loans to do ordinary things, a car at a reasonable rate, furniture.
All right, let me play devil's advocate here. That, like I said, this is at least considered by some, as you pointed out in a brief note before the that we all know people that would, especially because America is so heavily armed, that they would shoot people like us, even for supporting reparations.
Yes,
they would take up arms. This is the biggest anathema to many white Americans, or brown Americans, or even black Americans.
What's the name of that real heavy radio host who does a lot of talking?
Lindbergh?
Oh, well, I think it would set him off big time. It has in the past.
Oh, that's how
the whole
spells.
Idea is, I think he's made a lot of mileage out of
the
whole idea.
I would love to see his head explode.
It's exploded many times, but it's still on there.
We have people sitting within earshot of us that whose heads would explode. Just the thought of reparations is just the thought of paying. It's over. It's done. They lost. Move on.
There's a host of questions, and Coates divides it two things. What's the fair, just thing to do? And he has a quote from the Bible, you had to be Jewish. You had to be a Hebrew man. But if you had a slave for 6 years, after 6 years, from Deuteronomy, then you had to release the person and give him compensation in the seventh year.
Right.
So it's not without precedent. And in fact, when Coates looks back at early American, there were revolts of white indentured servants and black slaves joining each other to revolt and flee north and stuff. Originally, they were allies.
My ancestors were indentured servants. And the difference was that African Americans were never got out of their indentured servancy, and I mean they were slaves, and people like my ancestors were contracted to work for 5 to 10 years, depending on the contract, to pay for their passage over,
right.
And then at the end of the contract, my ancestor was given 40 acres.
What happens? The reason there's a revolt of white indentured servants is because they're all the same kind of gimmicks that were used against black folks to keep them indentured longer than they signed up for.
And many of them
that set off, some fairly violent revolts.
Many of them died as indentured servants because they were worked so hard.
So Coates divides it in two things. What's fair? What's just? What's the really American thing to do? What will heal the country? And the other question is the practical question of what this would mean, which I think first Mike alluded to. First, they would be absolutely violent. I don't know. Insurrectionary stuff. People would get their gun. People would refuse to pay reparation. They, you hear what's the guy, Clive Bundy's, black folks were better off under slavery. You'd hear that. You'd hear all the rest of this stuff. And there would be a revolt. Secondly, we're in the middle of a long decade, multi-decade long process, right, Gary, of the middle class collapsing and middle class wages. So you would be asking for reparations from people who are hurting now more than they've ever hurt before, when you can no longer make the kind of money in today's dollars that you could make as a working guy back in the 60s and 70s. And so right when people are feeling the worst and feeling poor, that's one objection. The other objection is, look, my ancestors arrived here last week. I didn't have anything to do with any of this. I didn't steal any land from any Native American. I didn't put anybody in slavery. I shouldn't have to pay for reparations for something that our family didn't do. Or you could say, like, my family, well, we were against slavery, and so, and so forth and so on. So there's the question of what would be fair in terms of who is paying, whether anybody should pay, and then where would it stop? Because if Coates focuses just on African Americans, what about Native Americans? There are reparations. When I was growing up in Oklahoma, people, my dad's friends would sue the government for fishing rights of a river in eastern Oklahoma, and they would get some money from the feds to compensate them. So there has been some compensation.
So
what would be real reparations for Native Americans?
Native Americans are still waiting for the money from the mineral rights on the land that they allegedly still own.
You walk into the office of the the Yavapai Apache down here in Camp Verde, in Middle Verde. They have a map behind the chairman's desk of the what they consider their reservation, that's which is 10 miles from the center point of the Verde River, extending for, I think, 66 miles between from, you know, the other side of Camp Verde to beyond Cottonwood. That's what they that's what was given to them, and that's what they consider their reservation. Now, we know what they have. They have that little patch in Camp Verde. They have 600 acres in Middle Verde, and they have another few acres over in Clarkdale. And maybe a total of 800 acres, and that's large, is the current Yavapai Apache Res. So a far cry from 10 miles from the center of the Verde River. Some of the, obviously all or most of the prime real estate in the Verde Valley.
We give it all back. I mean, in Oklahoma, they broke up all the tribal lands into individual holdings. And then they more or less, white people more or less, let's be honest, stole.
Right.
And
legally.
Ripped off all
legal
the Indian,
ways
off the
it.
Indian land through these legal machinations. The Osage were once one of the richest people on the earth with their oil. Within about 40 years, most of their oil rights were owned by white people, pseudo-Indian folks, and so forth and so on.
But they'll show you
we
the
never want to talk about the dark side of American history. We've slavery and what would happen
to Native
American.
No, you bring this up, what you hear is, this is the, what's wrong with it? Why are you an America hater? This is the greatest country, has been, will be, and your comments are not, first of all, blatant political lies is what I have heard already. And your,
what's the lie part of it, do they say, Mike?
That's just not true.
That there wasn't slavery, or there wasn't all this pattern of ripping people off, or what?
Yeah, well, the Yavapai Apaches cut people's throats in the night. That African Americans will rob you blind, and did in cities all over the.
I've heard that justification. Look at all the black on white violence, and therefore the debts paid. Some people will argue that.
Well, let's compare that now to the white on black violence over the many years, and you know it's. I think that the issue is, I think reparations are really unlikely. I think we would do everyone a big favor if we would just stop the theft from minorities and stop the discrimination. I mean, there was a thing in the article, Coates article about, Wells Fargo had a banking unit or mortgage unit that was devoted to foreclosing on black churches following the
they went around to black churches and got the ministers to give speeches about buying your own home right before the crisis hit. What they found is they sold all these subprime mortgages in black communities. It's sort of an iteration of what had happened earlier, but one of the studies showed that For example, a black person who makes $100,000 a year, a family that makes $100,000 a year, likely lives in a white neighborhood where the average income is $30,000 a year. With the subprime mortgages, they found that they sold subprime mortgages to a guy who's a black banker who lives in the area. It didn't matter, you know, they sold only subprime mortgages to these people, whether they were justified based on their economic situation or not. So that's what Gary's alluding to. But let me ask you, Gary.
The ARM was the adjustable rate mortgage was basically a modern day version of the contract sale that you were talking about back prior to the 1960s and 70s.
Let me ask you this, both of you guys, what you think on that. You've seen Coates' article. He's been on all the liberal shows. We're talking about Bill Moyers, and Bill Moyers discussed it with him and stuff.
Yeah, I like that you
What do you think? Was it useful for him to bring up this idea of reparations or not? And do you favor reparations? And if so, how? Gary?
I think it's always useful to talk about, you know, issues. And certainly if you know, as I mentioned, we're only 3 to 5 generations removed from slavery. And all of the discrimination and the theft that's taken place over the ensuing generations, I think we need to have a national discussion about it. You know, what do we do to make these people whole and to level the playing field? I mean, we still have discrimination with regard to schools.
Black students
get less money per student than white students.
Suppose we didn't and we stopped all the discrimination. There was just a line, a date line. All discrimination stopped. Would that be it, or would we still owe people who were discriminated generations
for a lot of people, that's what affirmative action was. Affirmative action was a way of doing, of making reparations. You know, we're going to stop, not only are we going to stop discrimination. I mean, I would ask students and I would ask adults, do you think discrimination still exists in hiring? Do you think, if black people get hired at a, and every one of them say, yeah, I think that's true. I believe African Americans do not get jobs because of their color. And I think white people do get jobs because of, then there's a need. Then liberals would say, well, there's a need for affirmative action. Affirmative action was saying, this is a way of erasing the past. Because we're giving you this,
some preferential
treatment in getting a job. So,
and we have to be honest. I mean, I know people who are terribly bitter. Their father taught at a college, and he was a white guy, of course, and he gets replaced by a black woman.
Well, and he paid the price for he paid the price of reparations.
But this story of the unfairness of affirmative action gets passed down from generation to generation. I have no idea of its accuracy. The one may be a better accountant teacher than he was, but it gets passed down. The resentment gets passed down for generations based on losing out during the period when affirmative action was the most intense.
For every one of those stories, there are hundreds of stories of worse things that happened to African Americans following the end of the Civil War and up to today.
Well, thousands and thousands.
But they don't control the media, and they don't control the narrative.
We do these basic things. First of all, owning another person. And we talk about slavery when we throw that word. That's a nice, quite frankly, whitewashed term. We're talking about people owning other people. Not only owning the fathers, they own the mothers, they own the children. They owned them, and they sold them. I mean, you could come
sold home. Sold them separately.
You could, too. Exactly. You come home from work one day, and your son is gone. I sold him. And I sold your wife, too.
I'm sorry. I'm short of money.
As far as I'm concerned.
I sold off your kids and your wife.
As far as I'm concerned, only in the last 10 or 12 years have they really been able to, they meaning writers, movies, the powerful message bringers in this country, only have recently been able to deliver exactly how huge being owned was and owning someone else was. And plus, what a great economic gain. It's a big deal. Now, as far as Americans,
you mean a huge amount of I guess what I've been reading is a huge amount of the wealth of the United States was
exactly
then held slave, right, Mike?
That would be the purpose for reparations. Now, in America, if my grandfather didn't own your grandfather, then you got no beef with me. So just because it was a generation, it was a previous white generation that did things to a previous black generation, or even if it's current, if all these realtors in Chicago in 1960 did horrible predatory contract loans to all these black people in Chicago in 1960, they ain't got squat to do with me.
Coates's argument, see what you guys think of it. Coates's argument, and it's a difficult argument, is a sort of in for a penny, in for a pound. You buy into the identity of being an American, then you get all the heroics of World War II. You get this wonderful creative expansion. You get all the positive things that's America, the first democracy. We still have the oldest constitution still going, so forth and so on. We have all these wonderful things. You buy into the good stuff, Coates said, you have to buy into the dark side too. You have to buy into the negative side. And so you have to own both. That's his argument. And his argument is everybody has to own that. Is what do you think?
That's a good argument, but you'd play hell getting people to admit there is a dark side. But I think maybe after some conversation, even your gun-toting buddies down at the Jeep place would have to admit there's some dark side here.
But they just want it over. It's over. We have affirmative action. The Native Americans are a lot of times doing quite well. In fact, as you're asking, it's a working class guy who's barely getting by. He and his wife are working, and he has trouble. And then you've got an African-American stockbroker who's got tons of money. And there's all kinds of issues like that. Like, well, you know, what am I paying this guy? He's doing great, and I'm not doing so great. And, and whatever land our family owned 200 years ago, we don't have it now. I barely own my house, and I got a mortgage on it. Why should I have to pay any money to anybody else?
Let's be honest. It isn't going to happen. I really would be stunned. I'd be all in favor of some form of it, but it's just not going to happen. You know, you have, as Mike pointed out, you know, you would have a war. There's, you know, since 2008, we've gone from 139 hate groups listed by the Southern Poverty Law Center to now more than 1,000. And that's the result of having an African-American heritage president.
There's almost a war now, and absolutely nothing's happened. It's all fantasy of persecution. Clyde Bundy's fantasy is that he has to pay for the for our land that he's raising his cattle on. That's a terrible burden on him.
Plus, you have this myth.
If you had a real burden, if they were taking money out of your paycheck, and Coates said one of the professors suggested back in the 1970s, it would be the difference between white economic income and black economic income taken overall. It would be $34 billion that would have to be paid over several years. In today's dollars, it must be $100 billion. And he suggested it as spent on education and so forth and so on, not given out, you know.
Plus, you have this situation where I think most white people believe that we're in a post-racial, racist society. Because Obama was elected president, that everything's hunky-dory and that everyone's equal and treated equally, which is, you know, I mean, every study,
suppose they
every
are,
study
Gary,
says it's not true.
But suppose they are, do you still have to pay for a past wrong or not?
Well, it's
do you have to, if you buy into being an American, all the stuff we're proud of, do you also have to accept the debt that's owed for the stuff that was not so good?
My point is that I don't think the people that think we're in a post-racist society are ever going to agree to it. And I just want to point out, you know, we have, as many African Americans in prisons as a result of our drug policies and other issues as there were slaves at the beginning of the Civil War. So if you think we're past a racist society,
it's worse than that. I mean, putting people without any money in jail, that's too easy, and especially in private prisons where other people make a lot of money, including black people if they have shares in the private prison industry.
Statistically, the best way to end up on death row is to not have your own lawyer.
Exactly.
We have
the record. So I'm going to address post-racial, and then I want to address Steve's question, and that's, you know, should we be paying? The white lawmakers have done everything and continue to do and will contend with the full support of their constituencies to sabotage anything this black president does. Anything. We make jokes, we have cartoons about obstructionism, about Obama can say it's Monday, and immediately the white members of Congress would argue all day until it became Tuesday and then say, see, he's wrong again. So I mean, this is no small thing. There is to be no cooperation on anything with this president.
But Americans elected an African American, a black president, by a healthy majority. Doesn't that say something?
5 million votes. This is a milestone. This is like the Emancipation Proclamation. This is like the end of Jim Crow, changing the law. So don't forget, we took all their money. And then we took the vote away from them. We didn't allow them to vote for another 100. And I want to mention that before our time is up. That's a big deal.
And we're trying to take it back away from them again.
And what do they see? How do white Republicans see that they can still stay in office by taking the vote away one more time? I forget. There's something like six in your state, your home state. There's something like 600,000 black people that don't have ID cards. And you know, people hear that, screw them, let them get an ID card. Like your grandmother's going to get an ID card, for God's sake.
Even the ID cards aside, and what they've done in a lot of cities, like in Ohio, is cut the number of voting centers and cut the number of voting hours. And we already had, you know, African Americans in the cities.
That's an important
standing in a line for hours
and
hours.
Let's go back to the question. Should there be reparations? Mike, you're our radical. I'm the conservative guy. So what do you say?
Yeah, well, like I said, there's not much room, not as much space on the left of me. I think there should be reparations. Absolutely. 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 If you acknowledge the real history of the United States, that what you're going to have, going back to your somewhat crimson-necked friends, will not believe the stories, and they won't believe the number of stories. They won't believe the thousands of people who had their property stolen. To this day, they won't believe the thousands of predatory loans.
Why is that? They just don't want to believe it because it puts them into difficulty. Because
you're an America hater.
For the same reason for the same reason we have Holocaust deniers. You know,
don't want to believe it.
It doesn't fit the narrative.
Don't want to believe it.
That they, you know, their views. So,
and I don't care. You could sit there and hold up contracts. And you could talk about the family in West Virginia whose home is now a country club. And you can show, like the Associated Press did, the thousands of cases where hard-working black families' land was taken and is owned by corporations, by country clubs, or certainly by other people than those black families. And you can show document after document, and they're still going to say,
I didn't do anything.
My grandfather didn't do anything. Move on.
We were poor yeoman farmers. We never owned slaves. We never had. We never got any benefit from slavery. Why should we have to pay for it? And I think it's easier for folks to admit the crimes against Native American folks because most of the Native American folks were been slaughtered and no longer around. So it's easier to be sentimental about people who've been really broken and rather than a people who still have a strong population and 10-15% of the voting Americans are African American.
But even then, they're been herded onto reservations in remote areas for the most part and in poor, you know, agricultural land, and they're kind of out of sight, out of mind.
We're not the only culture. We're not the only civilization to face this. The model is out there. There's several models out there. We can look at South Africa. We can look at Australia. We can look at New Zealand. Wherever there was
Caribbean.
We can look at those models. If we were true Americans, we would take the best ideas from those models, just like we did with our founding documents, and fold them in to make America whole. Fold them into our system, and some sort of reparations on some level is required.
So the article we're talking about that's provoked all this discussion is by Ta-Nehisi Coates. It's in the Atlantic, the May 21st issue. It's called The Case for Reparations. It makes the argument. It's well worth reading. And, of course, he's an extraordinarily good writer, which is how he got to be.
Let me change subjects real quick. Are we going to talk about the film school next week?
I don't know yet. Mike?
We're still trying to make arrangements.
All right. An upcoming show will be the Sedona Film School. What do you got there? You only got a few seconds.
Okay. Join us next week for whatever we're talking about.
Okay.
Or whatever Mike is talking about, and I'm talking about something else, and Gary's talking.
Been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.